Hey Levi, welcome to the show.
Hey, Nataraj, good to be here.
So you're obviously now well known for being a Web3 critic, I guess. But I thought of start to talk about we can start the conversation to talk, what you did before this, because I think most people are recognizing you as, the prime critic of Web3 and Web3 use cases. But you've done a bunch of stuff, right? Like you, I think you're also one of your companies is backed by YC. You've done a company before that. So talk to me a little bit about your background and, before actually getting viral on Twitter.
Sure, yeah. So my background begins in Israel. I moved to the US when I was four. So I'm pretty much American, but I know Hebrew. Went to college at UC Berkeley. I've been a lifelong programmer. So I got into programming at age nine, just started, messing around with BASIC, the programming language. I studied computer science at UC Berkeley. And funny enough, I actually did a bunch of electives in cryptography. So that was kind of foreshadowing my crypto obsession. And then right out of college, I had a real job as an engineer for a couple of years. And then I started a company called Quixie when I was only 21. Didn't really know what I was doing, but we were extremely good at fundraising. So I got firsthand experience raising a ton of money, kind of getting ahead of our skis, more money than we deserved. By the end, we got a strategic partnership with Alibaba. We were making 20 million a year. We raised 170 million total in investment, which these days it's like, oh yeah, everybody's raising 170 million. But at the time, it was like very unusual. And we basically just lit the money on fire and failed. We had nothing to show for it. And I was there for 6 years. So that was kind of my first experience in startups. It was a pretty unique ride. Usually, bad ideas, bad execution doesn't get you that far. In my case, it did. And so I kind of know what it's like doing a company that's like the inside of the Titanic when it's kind of doomed to fail and everybody's kind of like still thinking it's not. So that was my first startup experience. And then I got out of there in 2016. And for my next company, I still had a chip on my shoulder and I wanted to do another startup. So I founded Relationship Hero, which is still going actually, relationshiphero.com. We do relationship coaching. And that's a very different business. It's actually a profitable business. We have over 100 full-time coaches. We've served hundreds of thousands of clients. So it's very different. The scale is it's a high single-digit millions. So it's still, relatively small scale, but it's like a real business and it's on a nice growth trajectory. So that's my day job right now. And obviously I've taken a lot of time in these last couple of months to really focus on my crypto skepticism. So it's almost like a partial sabbatical. I think, I think the tide is turning and there's not that much more crypto skepticism to do.
So you mentioned Quixie, right? Your first company. Like you, I mean, you're being candid about like there wasn't a big use case, and you've not done a good job in terms of or your team or the company in terms of like using that funding, and you were ahead of your skis. Were you? When did you realize that?
Yeah, when did I realize we got ahead of our skis? The realization takes kind of time to dawn, right? I mean, by the end of the journey, I was like, wow, really the last couple of years, like, when did the idea stop making sense? Right? Like you kind of do a post-mortem, you're like, wow. And different people in the company reach the conclusion at different times, right? So like Quixie, we officially shut down in 2017. I left the company in 2016. The time when I'm like, wow, this really didn't make sense goes all the way back to 2015. So, these things take time and different, different components come into play. For example, I had the realization of like, wow, we have way too many employees for like the level of validation we've achieved, which is a theme you're now seeing in crypto space, right? As you're seeing a lot of funding and a lot of employees. And a lot of investment without the demand. So, it's a lot of the experiences in my life, both from Quixie and from angel investing, are now feeding into my observations of crypto.
So let's talk about angel investing. At what point did you start angel investing?
I actually started angel investing back when I was at Quixie. And a really funny story, my first angel investment was a company you may have heard of called Coinbase. So that was the 2012 seed. So you know, I always make fun of Chris Dixon for having like the flimsiest investment thesis, but he hit the Midas list for his investment in Coinbase, number one on the Midas list. And I obviously did pretty well personally as a small angel investor. So I always think it's kind of like Harry and Voldemort, where it's like, okay, I got the same angel investing powers, but we went our separate ways after that.
This is interesting, right? Because I don't know how much, like, you have what, 22K Twitter followers. I don't know how many people realize that you are one of the angel investors in Coinbase. Like, I think the hate you might be receiving, everyone is like, you know, he doesn't know shit. Like, he's not an investor in anything. That sort of hate I'm sure you're getting right now. But I was a little surprised when I was doing research for this conversation that, hey, you're an investor in Coinbase. And I think you're also an early investor in Wire, which is another.
That's right. Yeah. Which, yeah. And they just exited to Bolt. When I, you know, even before I invested in Coinbase, I was actually tweeting in 2011 about how great Bitcoin is and how I had a little joke. I'm like, oh my God, the US dollar just crashed 30% relative to Bitcoin. So I was doing it before everybody was doing that. But I'm such a natural contrarian, right? So as soon as everybody else started kind of having the same memes, then I was over it. I'm like, okay, wait, now I need to go the other way. I'm like a very big natural contrarian, and my comfort zone is like identifying a cluster of people who I just think are like very wrong, and then like telling them they're wrong. Like, so obviously, you know, people have called me a troll. I don't think that's fair because, you know, I don't go cheap, right? So I have like a standard to my arguments, but one thing that may strike them as trollish is I do like calling people wrong, right? Like, oh, but only if I actually think that they are wrong. So yeah, so that's a big thing I'm doing on Twitter these days.
So I mean, before we jump into crypto, you did a YC company, what, 2017 or 2016, right?
Yeah, we did a YC summer 2017. So that's Relationship Hero. So we started in Y Combinator, and we've been going for a few years. We've raised a seed round after that. So 4 million total. We're pre-Series A, but we're already profitable. And the growth isn't so explosive that we want to dump a bunch of capital on it. We're still, and that's really when you want to raise. So we're kind of in the, we're just like a real business, which is very unexciting to VCs, right? But there's the hope is that instead of just like growing very slowly, we'll just hit on some vectors, right? Some new marketing channels where the growth accelerates. And then it becomes a matter of like dumping working capital in where it's almost like a guaranteed return. We might even do it as a loan instead of as a, you know, equity investment.
So right now, where does the business stand in terms of revenue or how profitable is it?
So it's high single digit revenue, and the profit is, you know, some fraction of that. I mean, you know, I don't want to disclose too much detail, but it's, yeah, it's, you know, it's like a typical profit margin. It's not like insanely high or low. It's like, you know, the coaching business fundamentally has pretty good margins. And then it just comes down to like, what is your marketing channel? And our marketing channels are basically just Google and Facebook. So it's heavily just like an operations play. Like we just like optimize the operations of just like hiring coaches and helping them match to the right people to coach. Yeah, I mean, it's just funny without the complexity of the VC world, it's like, yeah, I just like have a simple business and it just like makes money the way traditional businesses do. And it's like, you know, we kind of pulled over to the side of the VC highway, right? Because VC is kind of like a highway. It's kind of like a rocket launcher, and we're currently, you know, retooling.
So are you planning to stay that way, or at some point you want to raise capital and go towards the venture way, or like however big or small you want to keep it profitable and, you know, just sort of the MFM way?
Yeah, my first million.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know we both listened to that podcast. So I want to pursue whatever I see as the opportunity, and it's not clear the exact path from here to $1 billion. So I know that in therapy, you see multi-billion dollar companies like BetterHelp is really the giant in the space. They're a multi-billion dollar company that's already within, you know, Teladoc, right? So they don't really break out their financials, but, you know, they're very big. I think they're profitable. So there's not a clear path for Relationship Hero to get to BetterHelp because the size of the market, even though therapy is like a $10 billion market in the US and like huge, huge market, like 30 million Americans go to therapy. So relationship coaching just turns out to just be a much tinier, tinier market. You know, it's funny because I can brag that Relationship Hero is the number one company in the relationship coaching space, but the asterisk is the space is like very tiny.
This is purely interpersonal relationships. Like, you know, if you're looking, you know, to get a partner, like what kind of relationship, or is it just like, because in general counseling or like what BetterHelp does is for all psychological issues, right? What does relationship or the coaches on relationship period do?
So it's funny that people ask that and they're like, oh, relationship coaching, that's interesting. Because it's actually on some level we kind of know what it is, right? So imagine that you just broke up with your significant other. So obviously you've got a lot of emotions you want to process and you're wondering like what to do. Like, should you text them again, right? Or should you get back together after some time? Should you try to move on? How do you move on? So all these questions come up. And who do you turn to?
Yeah, I mean, your friends, family, or go to BetterHelp.
Exactly right. So, I mean, our number one co competition really is just like friends, family, whoever's around, Google. And so we are basically like, you know, we talk to you like a friend, but it's a friend who's had like all the right background, and like seen, you know, 1,000 cases like yours, and the advice is just more likely to actually be good advice. And then, you know, so that's how we differentiate from your friend is we're just, you know, friends tend to give you like, you know, bad advice. I mean, if you have certain good friends who are reliable, great. But friends have like all these biases and then they get themselves involved. So that's, yeah, so we differentiate with your friends. And then we differentiate with a therapist because a therapist is going to be more like inner work, right? Like, how are, you know, look inside yourself. How are you going to be okay with this? How do you process this? Whereas we have a more of an outer focus where we'll be like, okay, so breakups often play out like this. And here's like some tactics that work for clients in a similar situation. Here's like, and like, yes, we will do like some inner work exercises if that's what you want to do. But the domain that we help with isn't just how you feel and your mind, it's also the courtship. So it's a, you know, it's a two-player game to do courtship. So we do a lot of stuff with like communication skills and practical tactical advice of like just what to do.
So, what is the business model? I mean, one obvious business model is you help connect with customers and coaches, and then you take a percentage model. Is that the business model?
Exactly. Yeah. So it's actually a platform. So the coaches actually just they do their own coaching. So we hire coaches who have had some professional success with their own coaching business, and we just streamline their operations and their marketing. We basically send them clients. We match clients to the right coaches, and then we take a net commission of 15%. So that's basically our target profit margin after deducting a bunch of costs. So, for example, like we'll try to attribute the marketing costs, which are very significant, and we'll try to subtract those from the revenue that the coach brings in. And then after we do that, as a net commission, we target 15%. So at the end of the day, it's a good deal for the coaches because sure, we skim out 15%, right? That's the take rate, the Web2 take rate. But all the stuff that we streamline, it really is worth it. I mean, because they really get to focus on the coaching and on the stuff that they're good at. So it is a nice win-win.
Got it. So your primary focus is getting coaches more customers, and the space that you focus on is relationships.
Exactly right. So if you're a professional relationship coach, if you've managed to succeed as a business, which is hard to do because the market is small, but there are people who have the talent, who have really high, you know, customer reviews, right? And who it's their lifelong passion. And if that's you, if that's your career, well, then you can partner up with a number one relationship coaching platform and have a relatively stable customer base.
So I wanted to ask one more MFM sort of a question, which is, so right now I'm assuming, you're like FIRE, which is like the financial independent retiree, because I think in one of the conversations I had, like you're not really worried about your employment, you know, as more people. That's why that which gives you a little bit independence in terms of making these claims and, you know, directly attacking the crypto use cases, like
Yeah.
most people who do it in, you know, hidden circles. Where do you like, how do you manage your personal wealth today? Like, where are you investing?
Yeah, so I think it's fair to say you know, FIRE, like if like it's fair to say I never need to work again. You know, realistically, I probably will, but yeah, I mean, you know, my angel investing's done well, ironically enough, you know, the Coinbase, some crypto stuff. So yeah, so and that's why it's like I mean, it is a lot of freedom to be like, look, I don't feel like working for the next year, and it's like fine, right? And right now I've got two young kids, and so that's nice. But in terms of yeah, where I put my money, so it's not super creative, and I don't think it should be. So there's a couple of guides I recommend, like Ramit's book is very solid. You know, I Will Teach You to Be Rich. You're familiar?
Yeah.
So, you know, basically the advice he gives is like, you know, Vanguard, right? That's it's really hard to do better. So I've got index funds, I use Wealthfront. I don't know if it's necessarily better than Vanguard, but it's what I've been using. And it just puts my money in Vanguard essentially. So I've got a lot of stocks diversified all over the world. And you know, different bonds, municipal bonds, whatever, just like standard stuff. But then the question is like the fun part. So it's like I have 85% of my money in the like, I don't think I'm going to beat the market. So just like diversify across the market. And the other 15% is like, okay, now I'm going to try to beat the market. And so far, taken as a whole, that 15%, I've been failing. Taken as a whole, it's like I have some stuff. I'm like, man, I'm so clever. I made so much money on this. But then I have some other stuff of like, oh man, like this worked out so badly. Like I put a bunch of my money in Russian index funds. And right now that money's just like disappeared. It's like I don't have access to that money right now. And I don't know
why, did you put in Russian index funds? Like, what was the thesis then?
It was, you know, there was an investor that I really trust who was hyping it up, who I still think had some good points. And it was kind of contrarian, right? Like, I don't really hear many people talking about it, which makes me think like that's like a sign that it's undervalued the way I think. And also like the PE multiples were really attractive. And so, I mean, it seemed pretty good. And, you know, if they hadn't attacked Ukraine, right, then like, I think that, you know, the portfolio would be looking pretty strong. But yeah, I mean, I really got hit hard on Russia, which is why, like, at the end of the day, so, you know, I did like a postmortem. I'm like, man, how could I lose so much money on Russia? Like it was literally like 10 to 15% of my portfolio, and which may have like vaporized. The postmortem was just like, well, look, I mean, at least I was smart to, you know, not put more than that. Right. It's like, at least I knew my limitations. Some of my other crazy bets did make up for it. So I went short a bunch of stuff like Rivian, with my crazy 15%. So I did partially compensate. So when you add everything up, like my portfolio as a whole in the last couple of years, has just been like pretty close to a typical person buying the NASDAQ, right? Because like I actually got less hit hard the way other people got hit, but I just had my own pains. That's investing for me.
So I guess for angel investing, for Coinbase, can you tell like what is the exact look like for you in terms of multiples?
Yeah, the Coinbase investment. So I got the same deal as Gary Tan. So he is famously like a billionaire off Coinbase, except my initial investment was 10K. So roughly the return I got was like 1,000x or even more. But I was liquidating some along the way. So at the end of the day, I basically got about 5 million cash from Coinbase, which is like, that's definitely like an amount that puts you in the you don't have to work. Situation. You can't buy any house you want in the Bay Area, but you definitely don't have to work.
I was thinking how we should start talking about crypto, because there's so many, you know, starting points. There's so many subcategories in crypto that we could start talking about. But let's talk with your blog bloated MVP. Did you choose that name thinking that crypto is a bloated MVP, or it's just that, you know, you were analyzing different products, which you thought were like, I mean, MVP, the idea of MVP is different for different people. And, you know, a lot of product designers will say, hey, this is the level of abstraction you need to have for MVP, et cetera, right? Was that the original choice of name for broader MVP, or just that it later fit well with crypto that, you know, this is a big, giant bloated MVP?
So I started the blog in 2019, and it actually wasn't about crypto. So it took me at least a year to really start blogging about crypto. It was just called Bloated MVP because it came from my angel investing, where I kept having conversations with founders, where it was like 80% of the conversations were like, why are you building this bloated MVP? And it's kind of a play on the lean startup, right? So that book, The Lean Startup, really nails it. It tells you how to like validate your demand before you like spend a ton of resources building. And all these startups would talk to me and be like, you know, The Lean Startup? And they're like, yeah, we love The Lean Startup. Check out our lean MVP. It only took us a year to build. And I was like, that's not really lean. Like in your situation, you know, your SaaS app taking a year to build, it doesn't seem lean enough. I called my blog Bloated MVP because I'm like, I can't believe how many of these like really smart, well-funded founders are still making the bloated MVP mistake. And it's to the point where they have public betas. So I can actually just link to the product and I can be like, hey, look, this product is funded by $2 million. They worked on it for a year. It's live. You can kick the tires. And I'm here to tell you it has zero users. So like, how did this happen? And you could be like, well, you got to experiment. And, you know, is the postmortem, can you really judge? And my claim is like, yes, yes, you can judge. Like, this is unacceptable. Like, you know, to have a product that's this polished with this much effort in it with zero demand. Like, that is not okay. It shouldn't have gotten to this point. So I'm trying to, you know, to do my part. And I was thinking, like, maybe if people can see other people's bloated MVP projects. So when I get on these Zoom calls and I'm like, look, what you're doing, you're not calibrated the way you're thinking about this. This is the path you're headed. I can see your future. Look, here's a link. Look at this other project, right? So if you go to bloatedmvp.com, it's like, I hope these examples are illustrative. And this all happened before crypto. And then it dawned on me slowly over the years, 2020, 2021, more and more. I was like, wait a minute, is the whole crypto ecosystem a bloated MVP? Like, is it true that not just 80% of startups, but 100%, like a clean 100% of the whole crypto ecosystem is a bloated MVP? And, you know, I've carved out some exceptions, like, okay, Bitcoin, when you want to go around the government, you can illegally send money with Bitcoin, right? So I've carved out like a few exceptions like that, but pretty much that's why I like using the term Web3. I actually think Web3, because it specifically doesn't just refer to Bitcoin, it refers to like everything else. I think there is no everything else. So I love to be able to say that Web3 is just 100% a clean distinction. Like if it's Web3, then it's nothing. Like, and you know, as a contrarian who's kind of like a simple guy, I just love the simplicity of being able to accurately observe that Web3 is completely 100% devoid of value.
So I think, in podcasts, what you can do is you can give sort of extended reasoning. So I guess one thing we could do is like go a couple of use cases and see why they're not actually going to work.
Sure.
And I'll try to play a little bit of like devil's advocate if I can in some of these from based on my experience. But I think let's talk about the first one, right? Like, I guess, which is also the most recent one that you wrote about, which is Helium. So why do you think Helium is not going to work? Because I'll give the positive, which is because I want to give the positive side a view in, let's say, what if there is a LoRaN, or I forgot what the exact acronym they're using. What if there's a network like that, which is very usable, which is used for not just dog collars, but a bunch of stuff. You know, I'm using it on my bicycles and et cetera, et cetera. Firstly, I think as a product, is that a viable scenario that could exist? I think that's one point. And then I think the second question is, do we really need tokenomics behind it? And it does it, is there a way to execute it without crypto, right?
I mean, Helium is actually a really complicated case because there's a few different aspects to it. So like, just to break it down, we can talk about like, is LoRaWAN technology, which is like low power Wi-Fi, essentially that Wi-Fi that can extend a lot farther, but it's slower and it's lower battery power. So LoRaWAN technology, is that something that's going to get really wide adoption? And that could be, you know, a lot of people are saying, hey, Internet of Things devices, they're better when you connect them to LoRaWAN than to Wi-Fi. Okay. So that's a maybe. And then the question is, okay, if you have these LoRaWAN networks, is it okay for every consumer to just own their own hotspot the way that they own their own Wi-Fi router? Or does it make sense to network them up where and you know, be able to move your dog with your dog collar, right, from one house to another and borrow that other house's connection? Like, does that work? And then another question is like, okay, now if you do want to build like a nationwide LoRaWAN network, does it make sense to build it, with peers, right, with individual users, like setting up their own hotspots and getting paid? Or does it make sense to have like Verizon just set up antennas, right? So that's a question. And then you got another question of, okay, if it's best to have users do it, does it make sense to just have Verizon manage the network and pay them? Or does it make sense to use blockchain technology to pay them, right? So there's like all these questions. And then, so I guess that I broke it down into like four question marks. And I think all of the question marks I mentioned are like very significant question marks. And the interesting part from the Web3 discussion is really just the last one of like, okay, users should all have LoRaWAN nodes. Okay, I believe I passed the first three question marks. Now, should we be using tokens on the blockchain? But it makes it a complicated discussion because we kind of have to assume the first three. I mean, I guess we could just like assume the first three are true. And like, we definitely need a LoRaWAN network that individuals broadcast from their homes. And now the only question is, should we use blockchain to incentivize it?
Also, I mean, you could also say that I'm a startup because startups are usually experiments, right? Like, that's the way I think, because whenever I'm angel investing, like the question is whether, you know, this is an experiment that's worth doing, right? At least till you get to pre-Series A or like Series A, you're doing an experiment essentially, whether there's a market, there's a product, there's actually use case, right? In that phase, most of the things are experiments. Mm-hmm. So let's say this is another experiment. The problem, I think, what I've seen with Ethereum is like, do we need a global network first, right? Could we experiment this at a city level? Can
right,
we like
exactly.
find a, I mean, ironically, your blog name, can we find an MVP that actually, you know, can prove out this thesis? I think that's what is missing. And the second thing is the tokenomics. And also like, there are a couple of other general worrying trends, not with just, I feel like it's not just Web3, but I think sort of this FOMO, I think it's culturally a couple of things got intersected in last couple of years. One is like FOMO, one is rapid access to, you know, sort of excessive financialization of everything, which mm-hmm. sort of crypto sort of enables financialization first and then products second. I think it's like, you know, we have this idea of distribution first and products again. We used to have product first, now we got to distribution first, because, you know, if you can find distribution, you can create markets is one theory that people try to, like influencers do that, for example.
Yep.
Right. So I think these are a couple of problems with Ethereum, but I want to like move to the next. I think you've written a bunch about Helium. I don't want to like spend all our time on Helium, but I want to move to the next use case, which I think is also an interesting one, which is cross-border payments, right? What do you think about cross-border payments with either Web3 or Bitcoin or Ethereum?
Mm-hmm. So I have a thread about this. I think that using a cryptocurrency, it's harder to write it off completely and be like, no, there's zero value, because you can describe the value that there is as illegal money transfers, right? So if you want to transfer money and you don't want your government or some middleman to get involved who would normally get involved and make your life worse, in that case, maybe you can turn to the blockchain, right? It's like this rogue, rogue lawless system that may help you out. And so that's definitely a use case. And in, you know, the reality is, I think Alex Gladstein is like the biggest champion of this on Twitter, is pointing out like, yes, you know, it's freedom and Ukrainian protesters, you know, the Russian government would never allow USD fiat to enter their bank accounts, but with Bitcoin it can. Or if you're fleeing the regime, right, if you can get a USB key or you can memorize the key, you flee the regime and your Bitcoin wallet is still there, or Monero or whatever it's going to be. So okay, illegal money, great. But there's major, major caveats to that use case.
Yeah, and also like in terms of like pure technology, right? I don't see how, I mean, blockchain we consider it as a database. So if it's a database, like is it a better database? Is it a better technology for cross-border payments? Like, for example, I use cross-border payments as a consumer all the time because I grew up in India and I moved to the US and I do a USD to rupee conversion all the time. And it's pretty straightforward. I mean, if you use Zoom and if you are okay with paying a little bit of exchange rate, it's instantaneous. So in terms of just pure consumer use case, I think it's a very hard case to make. As you said, I think there are certain very small use cases, like if, you know, suddenly the government changes or collapses and if you're trying to like, you know, flee that country. But even that case, I think there are certain problems with how do you actually get onto blockchain. If your country is really in that shitty of a situation, will you actually be able to move your assets into that? I think that's a question that, you know, that you have to work for yourself. And how many of the individuals really do risk management to that level? Like, who is risk managing their life or portfolios to that level that if this country goes down, I'm going to like, you know, put X amount of my net worth into assets like Bitcoin or ETH. I think it's a very small percentage.
I think there's just, you can break down the problems into two categories. Number one, I think governments will fight back much more than they have so far. And number two, ransomware. So those are two major, major problems. And they both of those problems scale with how valuable it's supposed to be. So right now it's very niche. Right now, if you want to have some cocaine shipped to your door by the US Postal Service, you can. You just need a little bit of crypto savviness. Right. So you need to go in one of the darknet markets. You need to make sure there a bunch of people are trying to hack you. So I know a guy who was trying to buy all this good stuff on the darknet markets, and he ended up using a proxy site that was just run by hackers. It was, you know, he didn't do a fully good job of verifying the digital signature. And so he just sent his Bitcoins to the wrong site, or his Monero. So anyway, so assuming you can navigate all that, which, you know, 90% of internet users don't have a chance, right, to navigate on that. So you kind of hit up your tech savvy friend. So the point I'm getting toward here is, like, right now you've got a small segment of the population that, if they're determined, they can do some small scale drug transactions, right, or firearms or whatever they're buying on these darknet markets. But it's necessarily limited. So imagine some entrepreneur was like, I'm going to make the next Silk Road 5.0 or whatever they're at now, and I'm going to be super user friendly, right? I'm going to make it like your grandma can instantly buy heroin. Then the government would be all over that, right? So there's purposely an equilibrium right now where if it's sufficiently hard, sufficiently annoying to get to, and sufficiently small scale, then the government will, you know, they won't go all out to crack down on it. And it's the same thing with Bitcoin in general, the currency in general. Like, as long as there's only like a slow simmer, right, where it's not like a huge amount of crime or a huge amount of laundering or a huge amount of Ukrainian protesters, then fine. The moment the government's like enough, right, then they do a hardcore ban, and when they really want to do a ban, I don't think you're going to get around the ban for the most part. Like, so for example, they're going to ban the on and off ramps, right? So Coinbase won't be allowed to let you buy and sell Bitcoin if it's a problem. So the whole thesis of like, oh yeah, you can cause problems for your government, that is inherently a thesis that only works when you're doing it at small scale. The moment the scale gets larger, you now have to tell me, why won't the government's best efforts to stop it, why won't those efforts work?
Is there a scenario that, I mean, I'm trying to like rationalize this, like in an opposite sort of counterpoint of way. Is there a scenario where there will be a company just like, you know, that PayPal owns Zoom, for example? It's one of the cross-border.
Yeah, Zoom with an X.
XOM. Like, is there a scenario where some blockchain is powering, or like even a company that will do these cross-border transactions completely compliant, but just uses blockchain? Like, is there a scenario that we could get there?
Yeah. You know, if they're just doing the same thing as TransferWise, if you could already do it legally, I don't think the blockchain is ever going to compete for legal use cases. I don't see an advantage. Now, I think that today, in some cases, you will find some rare cases where fintech infrastructure hasn't been built out. And so you see blockchain a little bit ahead. Like, if you really, really need to send somebody money on a Saturday, and for some reason they don't have Venmo or anything, I mean, you kind of assume into the question, maybe they have a crypto wallet, but they don't have Venmo. Like, I can construct, you know, occasional use cases where it's like, okay, fine, send them money on a blockchain. But like, fundamentally, I do think that the, you know, TradFi, structurally is going to be ahead of Bitcoin, because the problem is the only time that the Bitcoin solution is better is when there's like some big missing piece of like, okay, yes, this worked, but you didn't really figure out like the tax situation, or like you didn't really make sure this is legal, or you didn't get the protection that if you send it to the wrong address, you can reverse it. So like, you kind of made all these trade-offs, but like, yes, you got the value there. But at the end of the day, you would just prefer TradFi to do it for you, and you would prefer all the compromises that TradFi is making.
One other use case that that's often referred to about is like, you know, when Uber went public, none of the early drivers owned stock in Uber. Like, that's one of like a very well-known examples people give out when, you know, they're talking about Web3, that, hey, you can give tokens to early adopters, you know, that first, you know, Uber driver, you know, could become, you know, multimillionaire when Uber went public because he was one of the early adopters. You can incentivize early users. You know, the example often be used is, you know, you can airdrop tokens. What do you think about that use case?
I think it's a hollow abstraction.
So, I mean, is there a legitimacy to that argument? Like, why can't a new Uber be built using Web3?
Yeah. So just to repeat the argument, it's basically saying like, you know, systems can be bootstrapped using token incentives, right? I know that's an argument that a lot of crypto proponents love to make. And to me, it's incoherent. It's just not true at all. Like, the moment you dive into it and you try to just play through hypothetical specific use cases, you're like, oh yeah, it doesn't bootstrap networks. So to use the Uber example, let's just think a little bit more realistically, right? Let's dive down into the abstraction and paint it with some color. So imagine every Uber driver, in addition to getting their cash compensation, they're getting these tokens, which really is just, liquid equity, right? It's just a very liquid tradable version of equity. It's like the exact same thing. So you're entitled to a share of future profits of the Uber corporation. When is Uber going to become profitable? Let's say a decade after you get the tokens, right? But hypothetically, you're entitled to a share of profits, and that gives them a price, a net present value, right? The reason they're worth something today and people are trading them today is because, they're doing an analysis of future value. That, that's how the market's supposed to work, right? Like,
yeah,
that's where stock prices come from. Okay, so you're trading these tokens, and today, so you drove today, you made let's say you made $20 an hour, 8 hours, so you made $160 today, and also you got a token that the market value is worth $20, right? So that's like a realistic scenario in your hypothetical. Okay, now what are you going to do with that token that's worth $20? Your rent bill comes up, right? You owe $1,000 for rent. What are you going to do with that token?
I mean, you're going to sell it. Most people will sell it. I guess like, some will keep
or,
it.
Right, or like, or what if you're trying to like pay for drinks at the bar? What are you going to do?
Yeah, you're going to sell it, but again, not necessarily. Like, not all will sell it, but like maybe 10% will not sell it.
Sure. 10% will not sell it, but that's the thing. Is like, it's not revolutionary to just give Uber drivers equity, because number one is they don't want it, right? Like they're happy to just to take cash and pay their bills. And if they want to invest in something, there's no reason to think that they're going to want to invest in the same thing that they're working. Maybe they want to invest in their friend's company. Maybe they want to invest in buying themselves professional equipment. So just sticking it together, be like, you're an Uber driver and you get paid cash, but also you get paid Uber tokens. It's an arbitrary thing to enforce. And the theory is supposed to be like, well, then they're more motivated to work for Uber and make Uber a success. But then it doesn't work, because if you do the analysis, you already have a net present value of the stock. Like $20, that was already derived. Like investors, you already have seed investors or Series A investors that are already able to put a price on Uber. So once you have a price on Uber, you can put a price on the amount that you're giving the drivers. And that is going to be interchangeable more or less with just giving them dollars. And they want the dollars. You see what I'm saying? Like, we're not revolutionizing anything here. Like, we're just converting back and forth between shares of stock and money. And people want money. They don't want shares of stock. That's why most people don't even care to take the test to become an accredited investor. They just don't care.
Exactly. I was just about to say that, because here the problem is, I mean, there is one systemic problem, which is like, you have to be accredited to invest in startups. But let's say in a world that doesn't exist, right? Then you could basically argue that you don't need tokens for this. Like, if you want to build an Uber like that, you actually don't need tokens, right? Then just the way you're compensating your early employees with ESOPs, you can compensate your drivers. You can create an agreement, you put a bunch of lawyers and figure out a way. You could come up with that solution as well. And over time, you can standardize that. So I see that, I mean, tokens, like, problem with, I mean, with crypto is like financialization first and product next. I think that's the problem that to me is. And the other interesting thing is, it's all about incentives. Like, I mean, world is all about incentive. Like, how you design incentives is how, products grow, companies grow. And tokenization, interestingly, has incentivization as one of the most core problems. But to me, it looks like there's enough flexibility in terms of what you can incentivize. Because I don't know if you've seen, startup pitches in the angel investing perspective, like there's a lockup period for 10, 12 months, and then there is 24-month lockup periods for your tokens.
Yeah. Right. So you lock them. Sure. Yeah. So now the idea is like, okay, you're compensating the Uber driver in a locked token, right? And the advantage of that is supposed to be that they're more loyal to the network, they're incentive to do better. Yeah. But the problem there is just there's barely a connection between their performance and how the network does. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, if you have $20, if today you got paid $20 worth of equity and you work really hard, or if over the year you got, $1,000 or even $10,000 worth of equity in your company, the difference between you working your hardest and you not doing a good job is going to be a less than 1% difference in the value of the company and less than 1% difference in the value of your shares. So you're just, it's not creating an incentive. It's only like, if you think people are essentially dumb, like if they don't understand the connection between their labor and the value of their compensation, if they're dumb, then great. Then it's like, so now you're like admitting that it's a completely, psychological thing for people who are like too dumb to understand the actual economics of it. But if you just want to treat people as being dumb, that's a whole separate discussion. Like, I can think of a lot of ideas of dumb things you can do that some people might buy it, right? But it doesn't actually make sense.
I don't know if you've noticed, I think that early financialization or early tokenization gives you this false idea of product market fit, because your token is going up.
Right, which is really why Helium, you know, it's the reason why I quoted Chris Dixon and A16Z, because when they invest in Helium, they're like, we're so proud of the success story. You know, Helium is only possible because tokens get people to do things, like the power of token ownership. And I'm like, wow. It's pretty funny, like, because it's like, look, what did it accomplish? It accomplished, you know, 912,000 nodes, right? It got 912,000 ordinary folks to pay $500 per node, multiplied by 912,000 nodes to blanket the earth with these LoRaWAN hotspots that have, you know, $6,500 of demand. So that's supposed to be like a triumph. You know, you could have done that without the blockchain, right? You could have just gotten, you know, essentially marketing, right? I mean, having people make really irresponsible decisions to buy nodes is not something, like, I guess you could have used equity, right? In the future Helium. I mean, that's the funny thing is, like, it was a bad decision. So ideally you should have just not done it. But if you really wanted to insist on doing it and you wanted to give people the same incentive structures, then yeah, you could have just issued equity.
Yeah, you have a marketplace. You're incentivizing either the supply or demand side purely based on, like, you'll get more tokens. You can always, like, get blindsided with the actual use case. And you could probably make this argument for even the Uber example, right? Let's say Uber was not useful. Of course, Uber is useful. But if you're thinking about an idea which is not useful or doesn't have a market really, you could get blindsided and spend a bunch of money in terms of tokens. And you'll have, like, 1 year, you know, a company that's running for 1 or 2 years. But then once the token incentive stops, the supply side, which is, let's say, the, you know, the cars or the Uber drivers, really go away from the platform. I think that's where really the incentive design really comes into picture. And I think, I don't know why there are no strict, because I would assume not everyone is trying to pull off a scam, right? Like, there are crypto founders who are coming or approaching problems, trying to actually make things happen, right? Mm-hmm. Why haven't, or did you see, like, use cases where token incentives are not public, token incentives are not traded, but they're treated as purely equity to actually, you know, put it as a more long-term, sort of like an angel investment kind of a structure where it can take 7 to 10 years to actually make it happen, or it will only happen when actually there's a company or a use case behind it. Like, have you seen any example like that?
You're saying, like, have I just seen, like, a blockchain project where I think that, like, the token is reasonable? Like, it's, you know, it kind of makes sense.
The token only exists not to provide liquidity and trade on Coinbase, but it exists just purely on a long-term incentivization basis and doesn't have a price.
Right, yeah. So I personally couldn't name a project like that. I also can't really name a regular company that, you know, issues equity as part of the way they operate. I think typically there's regular companies and they do their thing and they serve their customers. And if you like those companies, you go on your brokerage and you buy their stock, right? It's as simple as that. And if you want to buy startup stock, you become an accredited investor, or you do crowdfunding, or hell, you help change the regulations and you lower the bar. I mean, right now they already did lower the bar, right? I mean, crowdfunding, if you look at the trend of how easy it is to do private company investing, there's been a very clear trend. I mean, crowdfunding up to $5 million is a new thing. The ability to take a test to become an angel investor, even if you don't have $1 million, is a new thing. It's a very annoying test. I personally couldn't pass it. 98% of angel investors out there couldn't pass that test that you're supposed to pass because it's, like, very accounting jargony. But the fact that you're able to pass it says you don't need $1 million, that's progress. So it's like, if people care to angel invest, which they don't, 90% don't, then there's a way to do it. And we don't see people knocking down the door of the angel investor accreditation test.
I guess, another important sort of use case, I mean, we can call it as a use case, that, you know, the take rates, right? The take rates. I think you wrote in the blog, in one of your blogs, that A16Z is gaslighting.
I mean, these guys are out of control. It's like they have these greatest hits of mental models that are, like, absolutely hollow. Like, you can't even say a single hypothetical example of these mental models, and they just keep repeating them. you know, which is why I have my term hollow abstraction. Like it's very funny that you can just like keep making a claim, and the abstract claim just doesn't map to a single specific hypothetical example. And so, you know, Web2's take rate is Web3's opportunity. Right? That would be like the catchy slogan, like Jeff Bezos, your margin is my opportunity. Well, Web2 is full of margins. I'm guilty of having a Web2 margin, right? Relationship hero. I skim, you know, I have like a marketplace take rate of 15%. My company does, because of course we add value to the coaches, right? They're very happy to work for us. We have a big queue of coaches who want to work with us because we add value, right? We earn, there's something called a positive sum, but the idea is like, well, with the blockchain, maybe a company could compete with us and skim less. And similarly, you know, Spotify, Chris Dixon's used that example specifically of like, you know, if only songs were NFTs, then Spotify, you know, which has negative net income, last I checked, somehow Spotify is going to be disrupted and have a smaller margin.
Yeah, that was very interesting because Spotify is not profitable yet. It's not making that much money when you compare with the, you know, other big tech companies. And they're actually paying out most of the revenue out to artists. But I think one fundamental flaw in this, you know, when Web3 pitches as creator friendly, I think one fundamental flaw in that argument is ignoring human behavior. The human behavior side of it is, yeah, there are, you know, maybe 10, 11 million artists on Spotify, but aren't we at any given point of time listening to just one or two big musicians? Aren't we all listening to Beyonce's new single? Aren't we all listening to Dua Lipa over and over again? Yeah. There is a certain element of, you know, being part of the culture which drives or like create the phenomenon called hits, right? Right. And yes. So how can you ever pay everyone the same? Like that's never going to happen.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, you know, when you back up, they make the claim that Web3 is supposed to lower your margins. And then I say, okay, give me one example. And then based on what example they give me, the claim becomes nonsensical in different contexts. So you add a context to it and it's just like, okay, this context makes it nonsensical. This other context makes it nonsensical. Do you have any context where it makes any sense? So in the Spotify context, like you mentioned, if you look at a typical artist on Spotify who's not happy with their paycheck, the fundamental reason that they're not happy with their paycheck is because users have a million options, right? And they're just not getting listened to that much. And that is a marketing problem. And that's also like a fundamental problem, right? It's a power law problem. So if you accept that your audience size, the amount of attention span that you're going to get for your music is fundamentally limited to like a few hours of playtime, right, in any given week, then you're going to walk away. You're not going to make a living off of that. So are we talking about like the most popular artists, right? So like the Taylor Swifts of the world, like, she only took home $1 million paycheck from Spotify this week. And what if we could give her a $2 million paycheck? Like, is that the vision? What is the vision exactly?
What about NFT first games? What do you think about those?
Yeah, I mean, so then I guess the game pitch is, you know, you worked hard to earn this NFT item through your skill in this game, and now you're going to go play another game, right? So don't you wish that you could still have like a comparable thing in that other game, right? So that's supposed to be the pitch?
Yeah, I mean, gameplay should be the pitch, right? Like I guess you made this point with Helium as well, I think, in one of your tweets is you have to advertise your product, right? Like why your product is good. But most of the websites today advertise why the token is good, what you're getting out of the token. I think that's also like points out to the philosophy in which people are thinking about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. You know, this idea of the NFTs and games, though, it's like I'm still waiting for like a single compelling example. Like if I try my hardest to think of an example, it's like imagine like two different Blizzard games, right? Like two games by the same developer where they're like similar games. I agree that if they're like similar games, it would be nice to kind of like keep your, you know, your character or somehow have continuity, right? And not start from scratch. But like, I'm sure that the single developer has thought of that, right? Like I'm sure that anybody who has like a focused use case has thought about how to solve the problem of like not starting you from scratch, right? So you just have to be specific about what is the problem. If the problem is I'm going to play two different games by two different developers and I worked hard to level up my character and invest in one game, well, maybe it's fine that I start from scratch in the next game, right? Like, how is it suddenly like crypto has made us like such geniuses that we think it makes sense to like not start from scratch in new games? Like, it's obviously like we worked backwards from like trying to justify why we need the NFTs. Like, it's not actually a problem that games have been having.
I mean, NF, The problem I have with NFTs is the NFT first games, because you can't start a game with NFT, like launching an NFT. I mean, the bottom up creation of games is usually through NFTs, I feel like is going to follow the same pattern as any other game, right? You launch 100 games, only 10 actually work. Out of them, 5 will make money, and you know, 1 or 2 will be the biggest hits, like Fortnite and etc. Right. And even in that case, if you want to really, you know, attribute certain value to the user's effort in the game, like a journey in the game, it's possible with right now with the database everyone has, right? Like Epic Games can do that in all their games if they want to. It right. doesn't specifically require the concept of NFT. The word gamification that we use in product development right now pretty much comes from the fact that we track those, we level up based on your usage, your achievements in the game. And we use that sort of like gamification everywhere right now in product development. So I don't see that. Again, why do we need NFTs? But I also think that there might be some use case with NFTs because you can digitally identify something. But the problem is the TAM, I think, is going to be very, very small. Like, it's the same, like, hey, you can auction off, like, technically, you can auction off anything from an artist, right? But how many great artists you'll actually go for and buy something off in an auction, right? It's going to end up as 0.01% of the artists. I think that's the same distribution that's, even if NFT as a thing works, it works in a very, small cases. Now, in all these industries, it's only going to work in that 0.01 cases. It's not going to work in other cases. Right. Because why do I need to take the concert ticket as an NFT?
Yeah, exactly, right? And that's like another bad pitch, right? Is your concert ticket should be an NFT, and because then you'll get like other benefits, right? It's like, okay, great, yeah, like a members only area, right? I can, that's like already a thing, right, that some creators offer. And again, the pitch you hear is like, proof that this is amazing because there was a musician and they were able to sell NFTs and they were able to get $50,000, which is more than they ever made on Web 2. It's like, okay, yeah, like there's always like random stuff, right? It's like when you have a system which is crappy and you have a bell curve of outcomes, and the bell curve, you've actually made things worse because you've moved the bell curve leftward, right? You've shifted the curve. But even when you shift the curve, you can still find people way on the right and they're like, oh my God, I got a great outcome. It's like, right, yeah, you randomly, you know, you actually kind of swam upstream, you randomly got a great outcome, great, but we have to compare you to, you know, the average version of you in Web 2, and you would have like done equally well, and maybe not you personally, right, but like other people would have gotten similarly lucky, and they would have had like successful marketing, right, they would have gotten attention, a scarce resource, a zero-sum resource, people's attention, it would have flowed one way instead of the other way, and it would have been arbitrary. So like my point is like when you hear random people making these claims, it's like they really don't have the context of like, that does not constitute an analysis that Web3 is better than Web2. You just randomly got people in your members only area buying your particular NFTs. So they didn't buy somebody else's NFTs and they didn't go to somebody else's regular website and, you know, purchase whatever their box set is, right? Yeah, you got the idea.
But the counter example for that, again, in the Web2, I mean, the Web2 is also a bad, I feel like a bad brand, is Cameo, right? Like some, like Kevin from Office made like $1 million in a year during the pandemic on Cameo. There was no NFT involved. It's just because people know him, people like him, people wanted messages from him. And I think he made the most money. I think the take rate was, I don't know, 15, 20%, because Cameo as a video platform was taking something like that. But at the end of the day, it didn't really need an NFT. I didn't know why. You know, you need an NFT gate in such places. So that's what I feel with NFTs. I think there will be certain digital artists who might get fame, you know, but again, that is heavy power loss cure. Like, and the amount of people who can, you know, sell stuff as an artist is incredibly small. I think that it's human behavior. Like, it's the hit human behavior that we consume certain things more than others. And that constitute to result in hits, and we'll always have, you know, culturally certain things are more important. So that plays out in media across, right? You can't say that, you know, I'll put a Web3 NFT on my podcast and go to number one, right? That's not going to happen. Like if I give token incentivization to here to my podcast, all of a sudden you will have a bunch of empty rooms with my podcast running somewhere. No one listening to it because they can instantiate 100 instances of Spotify, write a Python script,
exactly.
And you know, make sure that it's running all the time. And they'll say that, hey, I've listened to, you know, this much, you have to give me this many tokens, although the tokens might not be worth anything because there's no true audience build up for the podcast, right? And I think that podcast is another use case maybe you can talk about, where if it actually makes sense in the Web3 world.
You want me to talk about something that's similar to the podcasting use case?
No, just like the podcast as a use case in Web3.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this famously came up in my viral clip about Mark Andreessen, right? So Tyler Cohen asked him, how does Web3 help podcasts? And he was really struggling. He was like, well, you know, it injects economics into it so they can make up whatever business model you want. And then there was another Mark Andreessen interview that he did a little bit later. So maybe he thought harder about like what the heck he's talking about. And he said a little bit more coherently, he says, hey, the way podcast people monetize, they're not going to do it with ads. We at A16Z, we think there's going to be a shift toward monetizing by selling premium items to some subset of your fans. And we think those premium items are going to be encoded by NFTs. And then those NFTs can, you know, gate access to all kinds of different things in the metaverse, right? In addition to maybe letting you hear exclusive content, they'll also let you show off, right, your affiliation, and they'll give you access to stuff. So yeah, I mean, it's an idea that's totally possible to do on the internet right now. Like, you really don't need blockchain technology. You don't need to decentralize a place to, you know, buy stuff from creators. But I mean, I thought it was funny that they took this like super bold thesis, right, about like how people are going to pay for music and like tried to connect it to blockchain. It's like, when you're trying to justify that blockchain technology has like any value whatsoever, it kind of pushes you to just say stuff that is like very unsupported, like, really? So there's just like not going to be ad supported media. Like, you know that, you know, it's funny, like Netflix is now like moving into doing ads, right? So are they like, you're arguing that they just have no idea what they're doing? They're, you know, like ads are just going to be gone. Like, you know that, Mark Andreessen, like that's your thesis. And it's, you would have had that thesis even without blockchain technology. Like, you just thought of that. It just doesn't seem like you're thinking things through at all.
I mean, it's already being done by creators, right? Like Tim Dillon is a comedian. He has a Patreon page which does 200K plus per month, just with 40 subscribers. So average, they pay around $5. And he posts additional podcast episodes. It's basically the audio version that he already does. He has a free podcast on YouTube, but then he also has a premium version on Patreon channel. And there are a bunch of Patreon channels like this, where, you know, people do that. I mean, all it really points out to like this interchangeability and data sharing in the identity layer, right? And that is probably the only use case I see that there will be a product that, and I don't know if blockchain is really going to be supporting that, but there will be a product which will probably hold your identity and move across more. Like, if I've subscribed to Patreon, like it would identify me on Metaverse, like it's some API, I guess. It's some API which is holding.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of like a Google database or Facebook login, but with your wallet. Yeah. That's like a major use case. Before we got used to just Google and Facebook as login providers, there is a standard. There was OpenID and there's OAuth, right? So it is straightforward to become another login provider, but websites have stopped kind of letting you use any arbitrary provider. They just kind of like pick a few winners. Being able to log into your wallet, like maybe that will win. Maybe we'll get another button, just like we have login with Apple is like a relatively new button, right? Maybe we'll get login with your wallet. Maybe it'll be nice. I personally wouldn't use it because I trust Google's like security flow a little bit more. I know it's not perfect. I know that in rare cases, people lose access to their Google account. I personally would prefer to take my chances with that than with a wallet, right? Like I've already lost a couple of wallets that I own, right? That have like real money in it. And it's just like, and I'm somebody who's relatively good at security, and I just don't want the stress of losing my wallet key or whatever. But yeah, I mean, look, some people might want to log into their wallet. Hopefully it won't get stolen. That'll be fine. And that'll be like a nice minor use case.
I mean, in conclusion, like not in conclusion of the conversation, but like in looking at all these cases, there are three things I like feel always are intersecting in crypto. One is like you're always taking a long tail scenario, like even for that gated, creator will give you something, you know, a gated community for the creator where, you know, he's giving something special for an exclusive community. That it's a long tail edge case scenario, which although it's solved, maybe there's a scenario where I move to, you know, from Patreon to Oculus, that's not solved, for example, right? So there's some long tail scenario like that, which seems to exist, but the solution always, even though there's another solution we could think of, the solution always seems to be tokenomics. Like you provide incentives, like why is there a coin for this? Even for like, for example, ENS, ENS, which probably like if there's an identity layer solution, I felt like ENS might be closer to an actual real scenario. I couldn't fully articulate why, but when I was looking at different use cases, ENS felt like we've reinvented short links in a different way. Like, you know, tiny URL, the famous example every developer reads through for his interviews. We've somehow, like there's some real use case I could see ENS developing into, but again, the TAM is not going to be as big. And then I think on once you add this edge case scenario and then add tokenomics into it, and then what we have is aggressive form on digital marketing. Like you put it out there, once you give tokens to people, they become your sort of mouthpieces, right? Once you have token, and you can see in every individual psychology, like if, I fall that into that trap. Like if I invest significant amount of money in one company versus others, I fall into this trap of saying that this company is better than others, especially if you do it like in the 15% that you're managing. I don't know if you experience this anytime, but I used to experience this a lot, that if I invest in Tesla, I think no other company will beat Tesla. If I invest in something else, and this is a common, you know, sort of theme, especially when you're young and you're first time managing your money. I think that is another like compounds these whole two phenomena. And then the token itself takes another life of itself. So this, the product, the original long tail case scenario is all now a different thing. And the token itself is on its own journey of, you know, finding market cap on coin and going through that journey. I think it's completely decoupled from the original product idea. I think that is the important takeaway for me. So I think one thing that happened, I think, is like, why are we seeing, because you saw YC rounds in 2016 and you've seen a bunch of venture capital rounds. Why are we seeing this large of, you know, investing rounds happen?
Why aren't we seeing large investing rounds happen in crypto or all of startups?
In crypto and startups. I think it's not unique to crypto. I think it's all startups.
And you think that we're not seeing those rounds?
No, I'm saying like, why are we seeing those large rounds instead of, because at some valuation, the VC model doesn't make sense, right? There's not 10x, 50x return.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's a big trend that kind of sweeps over the economy as a whole, right? So the quantitative easing and, you know, easy access to money and low interest rates is one primary driver. And then you see the public markets go up. And whenever you see IPOs go at a higher valuation, it makes, you know, goes down the chain. So then the late stage investors are willing to invest at a higher valuation because they're expecting a higher exit. And it goes all the way back to seed, where seed rounds that were once 5 million valuation are now 10, 20, even 30 million valuation. And then now with the quantitative tightening that's happening, you know, a bunch of the public markets are going down. And so seeds are down from, you know, 20 back to 12, right? So 12 million valuation. And you know, it makes sense because when Coinbase, for example, had like a $70 billion valuation, right? That was like better than my wildest dreams, right? It was like better than the wildest dreams of anybody who invested at the time in 2012, because at the time, a 1 billion, 2 billion, like these were really, really good successful outcomes. Whereas now, you know, the decacorn is the new unicorn, right? So everybody knows like, wow, this could be a decacorn. So if I'm investing at a 5 million valuation, thinking it can be a unicorn, a $1 billion, and suddenly you tell me it could be a decacorn, and the valuation is not 5 million, it's 15 million. I'd be like, well, that's still fine, right? Because you're 10xing the upside. So I'm okay paying 3x or even 10x, right, at the beginning.
I think the interesting thing is also the incentives, because one thing that used to happen in VC is that VC or angel investing, we had to wait 7 to 10 years to get an exit, right? And retail investors used to listen about, hey, this is a startup, we couldn't invest, but it's valued this much. But then with crypto, we have this sudden merge of the worlds. Like we've almost like took a linear time and circled it. So they met at the, you know, whenever the company started, the token is liquid, everyone can trade it. So VC, which is a risk capital, which is an experimental capital, which made sense as an asset class, which still makes sense as an experimental capital. With crypto, essentially, like it meets retail very quickly in timeline. So I think it's that weird dynamic actually creates, it's much more problematic than, I don't know, a lot of people realize.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a, it's an ongoing area of research, right? It's, so there's no simple answer.
We have a few more minutes. So before going, I want you to tell me at the end of the day, what do you think? We've seen crypto valuations crash. I guess two things. One is, where do you stand with, is in terms of use cases, is there one or two use cases that will you think will come out?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that Bitcoin will be around for a long time just because it's always fun to speculate. Like anytime the price goes really, really low, you might as well put some dollars in and hope that it goes higher, right? So it's always going to be there as a casino, and it's always going to be there to some degree as like a side channel, right? So for whatever reason, if you want to buy drugs or, you know, you want to be a little shady, and because I don't think it's ever going to get major traction, it's never going to be like a huge pest that the government is going to fight too hard if it never gets traction. It's always going to be there as like this really weird alternate backup system that you can use.
And I think one last question I want to ask is, I try to ask all my guests is, like, I have this belief that you are what you consume. I know you consume a bunch of podcasts. What else are you consuming right now? Just give a little bit of idea of one or two things that you're, you know, actively consuming. In terms of information,
yeah,
obviously.
Information. Yeah. So besides podcasts and Twitter, I try to get some audiobooks in, you know, by some good authors, like Steven Pinker would be like one of my favorite audiobook authors. And, you know, some good blogs, Late Star Codex. Yeah, my information diet is largely plugged into the usual tech stuff and then also rationalist stuff. So Less Wrong, AI stuff, AI risk. I'm a believer in that. So I'm AI pilled. I'm definitely not crypto pilled, but I am AI risk pilled.
Thanks, Jerome. Thanks for taking time.
Yeah, my pleasure, Nataraj. Great talking to you.